Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Jane Bloom. On this program, we talk to people who have been affiliated with the University of New Mexico or are affiliated with the new university and have done interesting things. So I ask you, how many university presidents have become novelists? How many have written plays, dabbled in science fiction, produced TV scripts and poetry, and performed stand-up comedy? Well, my guest today has done all that and more. I welcome to University Showcase Dr. Richard Peck, former president of the University of New Mexico. Welcome.
Hello, Jane. How are you?
I'm glad to see you. You left UNM after eight years or so?
I was here for 10, eight and a half as president, and then a year and a half in the English department teaching English.
Yes, and that's been your academic specialty.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And maybe that's why you've done so much writing.
Probably. I always thought I was a writer, even when I was teaching. I don't know. That's what I always wanted to do from a very young age. My first publication, if we can call it this, I was 6 years old. And in Milwaukee, the Gimbel store there had a Christmas show where they read aloud children's letters to Santa. So I wrote a letter to Santa and sent it in to them. They read it aloud. I heard it. I'm still waiting for the check. I never got paid for that letter. But
it inspired you.
Oh, I will claim that's my first publication.
Well, you've written 11 books, and you have a new one out. It's called Schmidt's Mill, and we're going to discuss that in a minute.
Okay.
But you've written TV scripts and poetry and science fiction and novels. I've read at least three. Where do you get your ideas from?
I used to say Sears because they have a pretty good run of ideas. But I don't know. I just wrote a piece today. I'm collecting some short stories. And I wrote an introduction to it today. And the idea came out of a class. I taught what I was told was the first college credit science fiction class at Temple University. And several of the students in the class said they wanted to write, but they couldn't get an idea. And I made a deal. I said, I'll give you an idea, and we'll all write it this weekend. And then bring your story in on Monday, and we can discuss it with one another. And here was my idea. I don't know where it came from. But the idea was the Titanic.
It's called The Final Solution.
No. No, that was the book. But I had stories before that.
Oh, okay.
And it was a story. And I said the Titanic did not hit an iceberg. The iceberg hit the Titanic. Now go home and write that. And they went away, and one of the 23 kids in the class brought back a complete story. Three of them brought back a page or two. I had my story, and we discussed them on Monday, and I sold mine. It was the first science fiction story I had sold.
To where?
To a magazine called Venture.
Mm-hmm.
These were the pulp magazines. These were the glorious days of 3 cents a word. And so, and by the way, at 3 cents a word, there's no virtue in economy. And there are a lot of long-winded stories just because we were running up the price.
Do you have to know and understand science to write science fiction?
I'm afraid so, which is why I don't write it anymore. I'm very serious. I wrote it, and I wrote a kind of fantasy, and it was very speculative. But after a while, you get to know there are some things that you can't explain, or I can't explain. And science fiction fans are very diligent in keeping up with the field. And they know things that that are beyond my knowledge. And so I backed away from that. I don't write science fiction anymore. I keep running into it. My son, by the way, has collected a lot of things. And he has grown into science fiction. He just took a new job. He's number two at NASA.
And, oh, my goodness. No wonder he has to know something about science.
And he's a satellite designer. And so that involves all kinds of technology and science and physics and mathematics, and all that's beyond me. So I write fiction where I just make it up. It's all lies.
Yes, and we should talk about the fact that you wrote these three particularly I've enjoyed. You wrote Dead Pawn,
mm-hmm.
and a sequel, Jackalope Casino.
Right. Both very New Mexico books, I think.
Very New Mexico books. Mysteries in a way, they're sort of mysteries. What I was particularly interested in when I read them was they seem to be about a man named Robert Wentz, who was shafted by the system and shafted the system back.
Well, he got even. It's a lot of fun to get revenge, especially if it doesn't hurt anybody. And when you're writing, you can punish your enemies with impunity. They can't get back at you. It's very nice.
He's got an Albuquerque policeman who keeps after him.
He does.
Because the policeman thinks that he's done something that he needs to investigate, but he's not sure what.
Well, by the time of Jackalope Casino, which is the second book, that policeman, Chutters, is a friend of his and respects him but is wary, is worried that Wentz is going to do something he shouldn't. And now I'm working on the third book in that series, and the same characters are there. I told someone, they said, who are the people in your new book? And I said, they are all the ones that were not killed off in the earlier books. If they're dead, I couldn't resurrect them.
Of course not.
that's fantasy.
Well,
I don't do that.
Well, they sometimes do that in soap operas on TV.
They do.
Or, you know, TV. You also, I'm very interested in you said it was definitely a New Mexico book, and it certainly was. Do you think that we're talking about a New Mexican who was convicted for a crime he didn't commit?
Agreed. Yes, it happened.
And that could happen anywhere, right?
It can. It's not as common as writers would like to make it. It makes a very good plot. But because he had committed other crimes. I mean, he was not pure as the driven snow, but not what he was convicted of. And so when he gets out of jail, he decides two things. He wants to straighten out his life and get rid of that stigma and get back to work. He's an adobe builder. He's a contractor and wants to build things. But at the same time, if he can get even with the people who put him in jail, that won't disappoint him. So that's
and he
that's
manages to do so.
He does, without hurting anyone who doesn't deserve it. But it's not a violent retribution. It's just that he allows these people to reveal themselves. And that kind of public confession is hard to back away from. We have our own politicians in the state who have confessed publicly, and they think it's over. It's not over. That stigma stays with you for a long, long time.
Those books, in case you just tuned in, are Dead Pawn and Jackalope Casino, written by Richard E. Peck. And he's a past president of the University of New Mexico, was here until 2000, and then retired. And in just a minute, we're going to talk about the other book I read, Strategy of Terror. But it was interesting. You've lived in a variety of different places. Before you came here, you were at Arizona State as an interim president.
Just for 2 years, yes.
Yes, and after you left here, you went to the University of South Florida as an interim president.
I did.
But you elected to return to New Mexico and stay here.
Oh, yes.
Tell me why.
Well, over the years, and my jobs took me different places. The Marine Corps took me a couple of different places. And the list of places where I thought I would like to settle down kept getting smaller and smaller. And I got down to two places. At one point, my wife and I literally said, we're going to end up in either Albuquerque or San Diego. The two had very different appeals about them. And then the job came up here. And so that was decided for me. But I had been through Albuquerque when I was 12 years old on the family tour west. My father had a wonderful definition of Albuquerque in those days. When I was 12 years old, it was a long time ago. And he said, Albuquerque is 6 miles long and one story high. And it was.
At the time, it was.
There were no two- or three-story buildings here. They were all flat-roofed mud huts or adobe. But it was a very distinctive place, and that stayed with me. And I took a couple of pictures of the Sandia Ridge I have one picture I've saved all these years. It has two rainbows in it. I've never caught that before or since, but two rainbows along the Sandia Ridge because of afternoon thunderstorms and mist up there. It's just a gorgeous place to be. And so we like that. We like the food. We like the people. It's hard to find some other place. The weather is fine here 10 months out of the year. We're sneaking up on the 2 months when it's not so fine, but it's It's better than most places I've been, so we've enjoyed it.
And you live up in Placidas, and you have an outstanding view of the Sandia Mountains.
We're up on a ridge there, yes. Very nice. And we can see Arizona blowing by overhead in the spring, all the dust that comes from the west. This has been a great place to be. And I visit other places. I'm glad you remarked on this, because everything I've written has to do with some place where I've been.
Yes. And maybe we'll turn now to Strategy of Terror, which interested me very much because, in a sense, there was a similar theme to Dead Pawn and Jackalope Casino about corruption and a man who may become a victim of it, and he turns that situation around after strenuous efforts. And this is in Italy, and having to do with U.S. intelligence agencies and what I think is what's called a false flag operation?
Well, we had it's funny. When the Soviet Union dissolved, disappeared, or was no longer a threat, our intelligence community was suddenly faced without a definable enemy. There's plenty of enemies out there, but not so clearly defined as the Soviets. And then how do they maintain their budgets? How do they maintain their authority? How do they keep working? You've got to have some enemy to push against. Even Hitler knew that. You've got to create an enemy when there's not one there. And so we lived in Rome for a couple of years, and when we were there, there was an interesting phenomenon.
Yes, you were there in the mid-70s, 73 to 75.
And during an election, the contending parties were the communists on the far left and MSI on the right. I don't remember what MSI stands for.
I think it was a neo-Nazi party.
Yeah. And so they were contending for some apparently available seats in the legislature. And during the election, the MSI headquarters in central Rome blew up, burned to the ground. And the communists, of course, were blamed. And MSI picked up a couple of seats in the legislature before it was discovered they had blown up their own headquarters. If you don't have an enemy, you need to create one. If there are no weapons of mass destruction, you've got to convince people that they're there in order to keep doing what you choose to do. And the press...
that sounds kind of familiar.
The press defined this as, they call it the strategy of terror. If you are a terrorist, you've got to convey that threat to other people and appear to be the hero who will save them. And there was one other piece of it that was kind of fun. Every 25 years in the Catholic Church, there is a holy year declared since 1400. Every 25 years, or when the Pope chooses to declare a holy year. And on Christmas Eve of Holy Year, all the cardinals who can attend conduct a great procession through St. Peter's up to the baldacchino, the main altar, and have a mass said for the state of the world. And every time that's done, it's on live television. Last time, there were over 250 million TV sets worldwide watching this. Well, if you are a terrorist and you want attention for your cause, that's a wonderful place to attack, the time and place, because it's going to be covered live all over the world.
And that's the premise of Strategy of Terror.
And only one man can stop that. Luckily, I'd found him.
You certainly did.
And so he does.
A freelance intelligence agent.
Former intelligence agent, yes. Former gymnast. A lot of quivers, a lot of arrows in his quiver.
Yes, he does. He performs several feats of derring do.
And that's probably what the thriller has to do. I recently had a chance to talk to a group of people about how to write a thriller. As distinct from a mystery, very different kind of thing. And the thriller, the hero doesn't solve a crime already committed. His task is to prevent a disaster from being committed. He knows it's down the road somewhere. He's got to stop it. And so that's a lot of fun to write that.
Well, I know that, for example, that you researched Adobe Construction for Dead Pawn and Jackalope Casino, which we've talked about. And even Prison Life and Car Theft, probably, for those two novels. But what about the feats of derring do that Robert Mason performs in Strategy of Terror? Did you research if that was even possible?
Some of it. Some of the things there are actually gymnastic exercises. He's a former NCAA gymnast champion. And his gymnastic skills get him out of tight spots. You've read it, and I'm sorry for people who haven't, because this won't make a lot of sense, but he's got to come down off a mountaintop where he is trapped. The Funivia, the tram car, is no longer running. He's got just moments to get down that hill and in under gunfire, and he does by using the skills that a gymnast would have. And so each of his exercises there is actually something that I've seen gymnasts do. And so it's not on a mountainside, not on a tramway, but on a high wire or on trapeze. And so that's not so hard. It's
And what about sneaking into the Vatican through alleyways that no one seems to know about but his young guide, an 18-year-old, and him?
But the young guy knows because his father is one of the what are they called? San Pietrini, the workers who work in St. Peter's. And they, of course, they work in the back doors. They know where the mops are stored and where the pulleys are that lift the lights up and down. And so it's that boy who helps him get into St. Peter's. And he gets in through a path that is visible from the street. If you are in Rome, you can look up and see these structures that I talk about. So I lived there and enjoyed using Italy. The other thing that's wonderful for me in the book are the meals. You cannot get a bad meal in Italy. And so when I got into trouble, I just sit down and describe a meal. It was fun to do.
It's a good plot device if you get into trouble.
Well, it's a good way to have a couple come together over a meal.
A couple does come together over a meal.
There is a couple, a kind of...
It's Mr. Mason, the intelligence agent, and...
Laura Conticello is
an actress.
Worker in a film company.
Yes.
And see, when we lived in Rome, I made a film at Cinecittà, which is the...
It's their great film studio, Cinecittà.
And I made a film about Temple University. We had a film class, and so I wrote and produced it. We had a director from Denmark do the directing. All the participants in the film were students in our film program. They ran the cameras and sound equipment. They were the actors. So it gave me a kind of false sense of understanding of the film business that I used. That's all.
Do you have a sense, and I've asked writers about this before, do you have a sense that there are stories out there waiting to be told, and they come in, and somehow they come in and nudge at you and say, my story needs to be told?
Oh, yes. I think that, in fact, there are stories that are told by several people at the same time. There are things that happen in the public domain, like the wall coming down.
The Berlin Wall.
Berlin Wall coming down. And I know of three novels that deal with that subject. And there were other people surely writing about it too. And so you get a kind of feeling, well, that was a very public and visible event. But the moon landing, for instance, that's been a staple of science fiction forever. And finally it came to be. The interesting thing is, in all the hundreds of science fiction stories dealing with the first moon landing, not a single one of them that I'm aware of said that we could see it on television. And the greatest excitement for me, we bought a color TV set for that night.
Yes, we were sleeping in the living room in front of the TV to make sure we got up for it.
It was going to be at 11 o'clock, and I called several neighbors and said, come on over, we're going to watch the moon landing. And one of the neighbors said, oh, no, I go to bed. I don't have time for that. And I really lost a lot of respect for him. I mean, that was one of the most exciting things in human history, for us to walk on another body in space. Just amazing. And last week, I heard a report that there has been a planet discovered with an Earth-like atmosphere.
Oh, really?
I mean, that is, oh, boy, I can't imagine. There are dozens of people writing the story about that now, or I would be if I were still doing science fiction. It's very exciting. And when things are exciting or puzzling, they provoke writers to try to share the excitement or solve the puzzle.
This is University Showcase talking with Dr. Richard Peck, former president of the University of New Mexico, but also a novelist. And he's been a playwright, and he's dabbled in science fiction, TV scripts, poetry, and he performs stand-up comedy and is a public speaker, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I do want to talk a little bit about your newest book. It's called Schmidt's Mill.
Mm-hmm.
And I sense that you've gone back to your Wisconsin roots to write that story.
Yes, I grew up in Wisconsin. And I knew the people who are in that book. I knew characters like that. And they seemed to me uncommon. I haven't run into them other places. Although, I believe that this is a small town, Wisconsin. And I think small town people in Wisconsin have more in common with small town people in Arizona than they do with people in Milwaukee. There's something about living in a small
rural.
Town.
It's urban. Rural right. versus urban.
Right. And so that's what the book is about. And it also deals with a phenomenon that maybe everybody has recognized, but in a small town, if there's somebody you know, this is a friend of yours, you will do anything for him. I mean literally anything. And when the strangers come to town, you will do nothing for them. They've got to work their way in. This is true in New England. This is true in the Midwest. Strangers are suspect. I don't know why that is. And I don't mean it in a mean way, but people are kind of cool and standoffish. And so I wanted to talk about those people because I knew some of them who were, on one hand, the most generous people I knew, and on the other hand, raging bigots. Just amazing to me how people can show so many different sides to their personality. And I thought this little town that I dealt with had that in it. So that was kind of the impulse behind it. There are a lot of people there that I love but I don't like. And so that's what the book is about.
Schmidt's Mill by Richard E. Peck.
Thank you for the E, by the way. Do you know the
That's
other,
your website, too, richardepeck.com.
Do you know the other Richard Peck?
No.
Oh, my. He's won the Newbery Award twice. He's a very good writer of young adult and children's books. I get 4 or 5 emails a week intended for him. I answer them. He never does. he wants...
You don't redirect people to
no,
the other...
No, I tell them. Oh. That's my answer. I said, here he is. You're going to have to get him through his publisher. He doesn't have an interactive website. You have to reach him that way. I've been offered a speaking engagement because they thought I was the other Richard Peck. And so I started collecting Richard Pecks. I'm Richard E. There's a Richard E. in New Jersey who's a plastic surgeon and specializes in breast augmentation. he has 2 books on the subject. They're not mine. There's a Richard Peck in London who designed skateboards and was sued, and I got a letter relating to that. A Richard Peck, one of our neighbors across the river who got behind in his utility payments, and I was threatened to having my electricity cut off. There are...
So it sounds like a common name.
Well, look up your own name. Go on the web and
I have,
it.
And
it's fun.
There's a jazz artist named Jane Bloom.
Now, isn't that nice to find out somebody else who's done things, credible things for you, or dangerous things in your name?
You were talking about public speaking and comedy, and that's just amazing to me. And one of the things I learned was that you speak to about 50 groups a year. You've been doing this since 1960. So you were a very young man when your public speaking started. What got you started in public speaking?
I don't know. I had a wonderful, flawed education. I went to a 2-room country school where it's easy to be a big fish in a little pond. And it just became commonplace that I would speak for other people. I would talk about different things. And everyone likes telling stories, I think. I'm a storyteller. I walked, now believe this, I'm sorry, it's not a story. I walked 2 miles to school every day. It was not uphill both ways, but it was tough enough in the winter, with 4 other kids. And on the way, I told stories. And when I ran out...
So you've always been a storyteller.
That's right. When I ran out of stories, I went to the library. I learned all the Paul Bunyan stories. I would tell stories to entertain my brother, sister, and a neighbor girl who we walked together. And it just became a kind of habit. That's part of writing, and that's part of comedy. It's just telling stories to entertain people.
Has your public speaking or your comedy changed over time since you've started?
Sure. Yes.
Tell me how.
As a young person, I was in California. I was trying to get into stand-up. And in those days, maybe today too, the easy route to get into stand-up was to tell something that was spicy is a polite word for it. I think comics are do pretty raw things. And I don't do that. And I tell stories, and I'm not doing stand-up anymore. But I do go around to retirement homes in the Albuquerque area and speak about living in Italy, which you and I both have done. Or I speak about the holidays. The holidays are a wonderful time to look at your own family and to see strange things that happen. We have a tradition in my house. If I have a second to tell you about this, I was worried because my wife and I both grew up having oyster stew Christmas Eve. That was our family tradition. I hated oysters. And I knew that as father, I was going to have to be the one to eat the oysters when everybody else walked away. So I got the kids aside one day and we arranged a vote. We voted on what we have for Christmas Eve dinner, and it's pizza. Because I said to my wife, that's biblical because the wise men brought frankincense, myrrh, and pepperoni pizza. But you see, they didn't deliver it. You're not going to give somebody a cold pizza, so they ate it on the way, but they had it with them. And it's also a tradition of friendship. If a man knocks at your door and said, I'm here with the myrrh, you're going to call the cops. But if he says, I'm here with the pizza, you'll go open the door for him. And that's a holiday spirit.
You might be right.
So we make our own pizza, each of us. And our kids now and their families have continued the tradition. And we get around on Christmas Eve, roll out the dough, make our own pizza the way we like it. We don't get to eat till 1 in the morning. It's a whole family gathering. Well, so I wrote about that. And you have your own family traditions. It's fun to write about them.
Do you actually talk to people about insurance underwriting? That's what it says on your website.
Well, no, but I have. I don't remember that. Interesting.
It says that on your website.
I've talked about insurance claims and insurance fraud because I have been involved. It's something that has happened that I've talked about. The website, I'll have to take a look and see what it is I am credited with or blamed for doing. I don't know.
So if people want to have you come and speak, they can go to your website. Is that right?
Indeed, yeah. No, that's a lot of fun.
RichardEPeck.com.
Easy. With the E. Without the E, you get this other guy.
You get somebody else entirely.
That's right.
What do people ask you to speak about the most?
Travels. I talk about traveling with kids. We travel a lot of places with our children, about traveling in Europe. Traveling just in New Mexico. There are wonderful things to see in New Mexico. You don't have to go very far. And so that's any excuse I've got to gather and talk about that or talk about my books. And that's what I like to do.
Well, if any of you would like to find out more about Dr. Peck's many books, including the latest one, Schmidt's Mill, if you want to learn about his speaking and his stand-up comedy, all you have to do is visit RichardEPeck.com.
Thank you for the plug.
It's been a delight to have you here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Wish you well. Copies of this and other University Showcase programs are available. All you have to do is call 277-4516, 277-4516, or listen to the podcast at KUNM.org. I'd also like to let you know that after about 15 years on the air of hosting University Showcase, this is the last University Showcase we will be taping. And as the host of University Showcase, I want to say it's been a joy to talk to all the wonderful people from UNM who have sat across the microphone from me. And I also want to thank our founding producer, the late Dr. John Jenny, and our current producer, Dick Fredrickson, for finding all those wonderful people for me. And I also want to thank our production engineers over the years, including Tristan Klum and now Roman Garcia, for all your wonderful work. And I want to thank you, the audience, for listening these past 15 years. I'm Jane Bloom. You've been listening to University Showcase.